Okay, I think we should make a start. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the APNEG Internet Exchange Point Special Interest Group meeting. We've got two sessions for you this afternoon. The first session is going to be full of the longer presentations. The second session, we're going to hear from, well, mostly the Internet Exchange Point updates from basically Internet Exchange Points within the Asia-Pacific region and around the world. Now, before we start, we've got some housekeeping. If you have any questions for any of the presenters, I'd like to ask you if you'd please use the microphone. And actually use the microphone and don't just stand somewhere close to it, because otherwise we can't really hear what's happening. Also, this session is actually broadcast on the net, so there'll be a lot of remote participants so that they can actually hear what's going on as well. When you ask a question, please state your name and affiliation as well, just again to help with identifying who you are and to help with the stenographers. Okay, afternoon tea area. You've probably worked out where it is by now, but it's over there to my left. In around the demo area, basically between the two sides of the convention center. There's the Apricot closing event tonight at 7 p.m. in the ballroom foyer. The ballroom foyer is upstairs. You've got the escalator that's there, and it will be in the lobby area up in front of the ballroom. APNIC also would like you to, well, I'd like to remind you about the My APNIC and the Policy Flash demo, which is running all day at the APNIC help desk. The help desk is available during the breaks. Also, check the on-site notice board. The note here actually says that I've got to show you the on-site notice board, but I'll spare you that if you just check the on-site notice board on the APNIC website just for any late changes. And tomorrow, there's the APNIC 21 informal closing dinner. I mean, it says it's informal, but it seems to be getting more and more formal with more reminders and bigger invitation lists and so forth. If you've completed the ticket payment, please come and collect your ticket from the help desk today. So from now and from tomorrow. If you don't know about it, there are more details on the APNIC 21 website. So before we launch into the presentations, just a little bit of administrivia. Two chairs of the Internet Exchange Point Special Interest Group, Che Hu Cheng and myself, Philip Smith. You can reach us at sigixchair@apnic.net. We have a mailing list for the Special Interest Group. If you're not a member of that, you can subscribe using the APNIC Mailman interface. So, to the agenda for the first 90-minute session. The Special Interest Group had no action items, so we can skip over that part of the agenda very, very quickly, and that takes us into the first of the four presentation/activities. And the first presentation is from Nigel Titley, who will be talking about the routing aggregation policy. Well, or more likely, the failed social experiment at Lynx.
This is going to be a fairly short presentation. Roughly a year ago, when Philip heard about what we were trying to do at Lynx, he invited us to come along and make a presentation on the Lynx mandatory routing aggregation policy. And it was expected to be quite a long presentation, with lots of graphs showing how we'd affected the aggregation on the internet and how everything was so much better. Things didn't quite work out that way. Okay, for those of you that don't know, the Lynx is the London Internet Exchange. It used to stand for the London Internet Neutral Exchange. Somewhere along the line, we lost our neutrality. It's one of the largest IXPs in the world, 205 members, about 90 gigs of peak traffic. That's on the public switch infrastructure. We're a distributed exchange. We're 7 locations in London. We're Ethernet-based. We always have been. And we were founded in 1994, so we're one of the oldest internet exchanges as well. Okay, to understand this presentation, you need to understand a little bit about how the Lynx is organized. It's a company limited by guarantee, which is interesting, really. English law doesn't have such an entity as an association, so you have to be a limited company. That's pretty well the only thing you can be. So each member of the Links owns a £1 share. Okay, so there's, if the Links goes under, all of its members stand to lose a pound. So there's not a lot of risk there, but never mind. And because we're a limited company, we're governed by two documents. One is the Articles of Association, which is very, very difficult to change. And one is the Memorandum of Understanding, which is much easier to change, and which really governs how we run the Links. It governs the rules under which the members must exist, and the sort of things they have to do to remain a member of the exchange. It's owned jointly by the members, as I say, and all members must comply with the Memorandum of Understanding, otherwise they're liable to be thrown out. And this has happened on one or two occasions. It's threatened quite often, usually when people don't pay the bill. But we have actually thrown somebody out at one point for routing their traffic through other members without asking. The company went bust fairly shortly afterwards. In fact, I think they were out of the country before we managed to serve them with their breach notice. Changes to the Memorandum of Understanding are voted on by the members at annual general or extraordinary general meetings. And overall, the thing's run by a board and staff. Okay, back in 1994, the internet was still really a sort of nice place. And the Links founders had a sense of social responsibility. And in particular, there are two social responsibility clauses in the MOU. One is that routing policy, must be registered in a public routing registry. So that's something like RIPE or APNIC or whatever. And the other statement was that routes should be aggregated as far as possible. Now, aggregated as far as possible, it's a terribly warm and fuzzy statement. And it's at the time, it sounded good and it sounded, everybody sort of understood it. But it's not very enforceable. And furthermore, we actually only checked it when people joined, and nobody checked it afterwards. There was a feeling that either we should get rid of this statement altogether, or we should actually make it enforceable, measurable and enforceable and regularly checked. That's odd. I'm sure I had another slide in there. Okay, let's go back. Right, okay, and it was only checked for joining. My slides have got slightly out of order here. Right, here's the reason why we have an aggregation policy. It shows the number of prefixes on the internet, and everybody knows this report. It comes from the CIDR report, run by Jeff Houston. And it shows the extent of the problem. Apart from 2001-ish, which we all remember, prefixes have been increasing steadily. And one of the reasons they've been increasing steadily is because people don't aggregate properly. As you can see, the pink line is what really we should be seeing, and the yellow line is what we're actually seeing, which is a bit sad, really. Okay, Links 48, back to the story. So when we have to change policy, we always go out and ask the members. Okay, and what normally happens, we go out and ask the members, we ask them to pass a resolution, then we go ahead and do it, and then finally we put it into the Memorandum of Understanding. And Links number 48, Links meeting number 48, passed a resolution to adopt a mandatory, enforceable route aggregation policy. It was a fairly close vote, 19-17, but nonetheless it was a mandate. And the council got charged with coming up with an algorithm and a means of enforcement, which we duly went away and did. And what we came up with was these proposed rules: that the total announced blocks from an ISP, not from their customers, just from the ISP's autonomous system, should be less than n times 2 plus 3, okay, where n is the minimum number of blocks that they could possibly advertise. So we multiplied it by 2 to make it a bit of slack, and we gave 3 on so that small ISPs could have a little bit more slack. And, well, at least it's measurable. And we were proposed to reduce this in 2006 to n times 1.5 plus 3. And I suppose maybe we thought that one day it would be n times 1 plus 3. But anyway. Okay, fine. We now have the rules. And somebody went away and wrote a script to actually look at the number of routes people were advertising and produce a sorted list of sinning members. And we notified or identified the members who actually needed to take action, the ones who would be in breach if this rule was actually voted in. And we gave a fair amount of time for this action, and we started discussions with members. We actually prodded them and said, look, do you realise you would be in breach? The other thing we noted was that you would need to make provision for emergency, for transient and emergency situations, and we'd just apply common sense in this case. And then the idea was that at Link's quarterly meetings, we would publish the list, and everybody would cringe down in their seats and go away and fix their networks. And this works quite well, actually. It's surprising. Okay, so by December 04, we'd had this thing in place for about 2 or 3 months, we actually saw some substantial improvements. Examples here, UPC was originally 8th on the list. They were well in breach, and they moved down to 63rd, well inside, which is fine. Limelight moved from 23rd right to the bottom of the list. Very good indeed. Colt, Internet, RedNet, Solnet, they all moved to 0% deaggregation, which was very, very good indeed. So what this proved was that things could be changed. And the members who did actually exceed the 2x metric did actually say, we're going to fix it. Okay, naming and shaming seemed to be working, which is great. One or two large ISPs said, well, look, we've got huge blocks of IP addresses. We really don't want to announce the whole /14 or whatever. Would it be okay if we just announced /16s? And we all agreed that, you know, anything shorter than a /15 could be actually broken up into /16s, and that would be fine. So that was okay. And the other thing, apart from serving breach notices, people suggested that maybe making route aggregation, good route aggregation, could be a requirement in transit contracts. You know, if you were buying, you were buying transit from somebody upstream, that you might actually say, well, you're in breach of the Link's regulations. We won't buy from you. We thought maybe. And to facilitate this, we put together a BCP, and maybe produce some standardised wording for people to include in transit purchase contracts. All sort of gentle nudges. And other people suggested that maybe good route aggregation was a peering agreement requirement. And if people use these approaches, maybe there would be less need for compulsion, however. And furthermore, we sort of spread the word a bit. EuroIX gave us a platform to explain what was going on. Most people seemed to understand, which was nice. We made an announcement at Right 50, a presentation, and we arranged to make a presentation at Apricot 06 to say how successful everything had been. RIPE also has a note that says aggregation is a responsibility of the network operators, but they encourage to aggregate as far as possible. So, what happened? Many, many members actually improved their aggregation. What came out of this, actually, was it was very, very surprising that most members didn't even know how badly aggregated they were. That they were advertising /24s and all sorts of crap all over the shop. And they just didn't realise it. So actually providing a metric to show them that they were doing this was actually quite a good thing. And they went away and fixed their router configs, and a lot of it got better. However, and this is where the story starts to take a bad turn, we started to get member backlash. And it was mainly from large, badly aggregated members, who, I have to say it, were mostly US-based. And they decided that an internet exchange had no rights to be telling them how badly aggregated they were. And they basically organised a member backlash. Remember, at this stage, nothing had actually been voted into the Memorandum of Understanding. So all of this was advisory up to this point. Anyway, we got as far as Links 50. The opposition managed to get the mandatory aggregation policy thrown out. Okay, so we had now had no mandatory aggregation policy. It was converted to a BCP, and we do have a BCP that you can look at, which makes recommendations as to how you should improve your aggregation. So, in one sense, the mandatory aggregation policy was a failure. It would have been nice to improve the general aggregation across the world, but people didn't want it, which is fine. But there have been some successes. Some Links members will, even to this day, still only peer if you meet the BCP. It did raise the profile of aggregation amongst the members and made them aware of how badly aggregated a lot of them were. And I say an online check's now available. It will be available very shortly. And it will tell you whether or not any particular AS meets the BCP. And that's the end of the story. Any questions?
For those who did...
Who are you?
Oh, my name is Bill Norton. I work for Equinix. I'm from the United States.
But he's not an ISP, so he's all right.
For those who did reduce their rank in the CIDR listings, what reason did they give for not doing that earlier?
Largely incompetence, I think, because it's not particularly easy to see how badly aggregated you are, and because the matter hadn't been raised to their attention, they just hadn't noticed. And I must say, Flag, my employer, was in the top five, and it was purely the fact that we had one or two routers that were misconfigured.
It certainly seems, then, that substantial success could be had merely by notification and finding the right people and continuing down that path without using any strong-arm tactics.
That was what we hoped, and we did indeed see that. But, I mean, the CIDR report's been going out for how many years?
Bingo. That's the problem.
Yep. Nobody looks at it.
No, they look at it.
Oh, they look at it and say, and if
Randy Bush, IIJ, also from the United States, that's what the J stands for. You write to the people in the CIDR report, and they say, we know it, it's intentional.
And I'm cheered by the number of people who actually cleaned up Europe.
Yes.
I would call it a success, not a failure.
Well,
you didn't succeed in changing policy. Mm. You succeeded in changing what was announced by the routers. Well, I'm a router geek. That's called success. You can keep your policy.
The problem is how long is that going to remain?
Maybe it's a process, not a policy.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. At least we have a BCP now, and at least you can... measure it. But again, it's likely to go the same route as the CIDR report. People will start ignoring it over the years.
The measurement tool might be interesting if it could be generalized.
Yeah.
Go suck route views or RIS and show me what I'm doing.
Yeah, but it does actually pull it out of...
No, but if I'm not a Links member.
Yeah, you don't have to be a Links member. It'll be generally available. You just put in an AS number, it tells you how badly aggregated you are. But then the CIDR tool does this as well, as far as I'm aware.
People it are does. Just so used to hitting delete.
Yeah, okay.
Give them a website they can go to and play.
Yeah, okay. So maybe there's some success there then.
I have a question here.
Who are you?
Hi.
Go who are you?
From BCH. Well, what I would be actually interested in from a Links perspective and... Not a general AS number thing is how many of your members say, like I've talked to a lot of these people who don't aggregate and they say that, but we can't aggregate our customer prefixes and things like that. So how much do you get that kind of?
Right.
Well, I mean, this is because you had probably had this discussion at the Links meeting And a lot of times I've seen ISPs say, we aggregate our routes. We have no control about our customer routes that, you know, we have to pass on as they are to our peers.
Yeah, you're basically, we're actually only aiming at the ISP's own routes, okay, not the customers at all. We decided that was well outside anything that we could possibly do, at least to start with anyway.
So I'm curious, Linkris from NetNode. I had to follow up to that question then. As the topic of the day seems to be traffic engineering, I just had to ask, there is this old mythical concept that as long as you peer, you know, there's even some RFC around this, as long as you peer, you can actually select what routes you want to have. As long if someone pays you to receive the routes, you can't. Or it's much harder. So do you think that the reason why you were successful, because these were actually peering sessions, as far as you know, but you can't guarantee that there are no transit being sold across links.
You're allowed to sell transit across the links
right,
anyway.
Right, I mean, you don't know what's in. Yeah. But do you see anything that the people who didn't aggregate might actually have been part of transit sessions or traffic engineering and therefore refused to do this? Or what would the people who didn't do this, what was it purely because they were large and an American, or was there something else behind it?
We never really got to the bottom of the few that wouldn't aggregate. Not all of them were American, I have to say. It was the opposition that was organized, largely by US transit companies. I won't mention the one in particular. But it wasn't just US. There are a number of Asian carriers who are quite badly aggregated as well. And with them, to be quite honest, we made no headway at all.
So, I mean, I made the observation that the de-aggregated routes are coming from carriers who are not local to Europe and therefore might be more willing to do traffic engineering than maybe European providers would be. They would have less issues with having to do traffic engineering.
That is entirely possible, yes.
Okay.
Any other questions for Nigel? If not, thank you very much. Okay, next speaker up is Jordi Pelle, who will be talking about, well, giving us an introduction to the Euro 6 IX project. Just a reminder for everybody while Jordi's setting up again, when you ask your questions, if you can state who you are and who you work for, or whatever affiliation you wish to announce, and also to try and keep your speech reasonably slow and clear so that the stenographers and the online listeners can actually hear what you're saying. Thank you.
Okay. I gave already a short presentation in the last APNIC meeting in Vietnam, and I promised to give a bit more explanation because we didn't have too much time at that time. The first thing to say is that this project started in 2002. It was designed in 2001, so obviously, some of the concepts maybe have changed. For example, one of the RFCs that we based the project on has changed in the last year or year and a half or so. The project finished actually in middle of, I think it was end of June of 2005, but I think the information here is still useful for some of the ISPs and IXs that maybe are considering to start running IPv6. The basic idea of this project, Euro 6, was to try to push somehow the deployment of IPv6 in Europe, which at that point, 2001, was still very, very ancient. So the idea was to try to involve the key players, basically the main ISPs in Europe, in every country, and start getting real experience with IPv6 and bring IPv6 into production services. So the main steps for this project were basically designing and deploying a real IPv6 network. As I just said, it was almost nothing available. I mean, real IPv6 services at that time. I am talking about basically 2002. Research on some advanced services in the network, which often are not available in commercial networks, neither for IPv4 sometimes. Also complement all the network experiences with applications that within the project and also involving people outside the project need to be validated in a kind of user groups and also international trials. So we tried to be as much supportive as possible to people that was not really involved in the project that wanted to get some IPv6 connectivity or try some experiences, or ISPs that wanted to give their first steps, and also be active in dissemination, standardization activities, and so on. Well, I think I can skip this one. Basically, it's what I said. The idea was to basically promote the deployment of IPv6 in Europe, but not only in Europe. We have been active in dissemination all around the world. And the members of the project consortium were basically all the European big ISPs. So we had Telecom Italia, Telefonica, Vodafone. Originally was Airtel, but it was acquired by Vodafone, British Telecom, France Telecom, Portugal Telecom, and Dutch Telecom. As you can understand, this was a research project, and basically the entities that participated were the research arms of each of these companies, not necessarily the commercial part of the company, but somehow we managed to involve also the commercial parts of those companies. One interesting point is that the complete idea of the project came out in actually, it was March 2001 in a European Commission meeting with a very, very small group of people trying to tell to the Commission how we can help to move on towards IPv6 in Europe. And there were a lot of people, mainly from university. I think I was actually the only one not related to university. And all these people was telling the Commission we need to invest more and more in getting more students involved in IPv6. And while my idea was, look, we are totally wrong. The universities are going to do IPv6 and are going to train about IPv6 to people because that's part of the goal. But what we really need to involve is the big ISPs. And while I got the task from the Commission, okay, you have 3 weeks to create a consortium and make a project if you can make it. And well, in 3 weeks I succeed to convince all these people, which was not really very easy, but I think the result is very interesting, because in addition to getting the European Commission funding, of course the European Commission only funds 50% of the projects, except for universities that get 100%. We also convinced the commercial parts of most of these operators to actually donate links, and that allowed us to make or to extend the project lifetime, which originally was only 3 years, and then it became 3.5 years, because most of the cost of the links, instead of being borne to the project itself, was paid by all these companies. This also proves that they were really, really interested in getting some results and starting doing some IPv6 things. So there was also two industrial partners, SixWin. It was at that time probably one of the first companies making IPv6 products. We had Ericsson Telebit. Telebit was a small Danish company that was just guided by Ericsson because the need for IPv6 in the 3GPP thing and so on. We had also three universities, Technical University of Madrid, University of Southampton, University of Murcia, small companies, like my own company, Telscom from Switzerland, and Novaginet, that is taking part more in activities related to portals and a lot of security things related to certificates, for example, and so on. And there was also another interesting thing. It was Eurocontrol, the European agency responsible for somehow the air traffic, which also during the life of the project decided, because at that time they were still using X25, and they decided, okay, let's move instead of just to IPv4, let's move to also IPv6. And, well, there is already some deployment in that network of IPv6, and up to now the planes don't crash in Europe, so I guess it's working fine. We had also, and this is very strange, I forget in my room one book, but I can show later you the link for this book, and you can get it. We involved a lawyer company, because there are always, when getting any new technology in production, some legal things that you need to consider, for example, related to privacy, data protection, and so on. And we actually did a very nice job here and even published this book that when I finish my presentation, I will show you from where you can download this publication. Okay, so this is the network that we built. Basically, we had one internet exchanger at every main city of the countries where this project was being carried out. So we had one in Lisbon, one in Madrid, one in Paris, one in London, Berlin, Zurich, and Torino. We also connected with 34 megabits links, only IPv6 links, these exchangers. And then we have different other sites, which were the partners participating in the project, basically, but also ISPs external to the project or other universities and so on. And of course, this network was connected with the rest of the IPv6 networks, 6BON, other big projects like 6NET, which was doing something similar, not related to IX, but also deployment of IPv6 in larger scales, basically in the research and education networks in Europe, and actually was the one that, let's say, put the knowledge on hands of the Giant people to activate IPv6 in Giant. And well, that's it, basically. So what was the main work related to internet exchangers within this project? Well, the idea was having an infrastructure that provides interconnection services for both layer 2 and layer 3. In such way that several IXs can make a direct offering of peering in one networks and behave as a kind of transport for service providers, and even getting every IX using their own TLA to assign addressing directly to ISP customers. So instead of being dependent on the ISP for the address delegation, having that from the IX itself. Curtis? Oh, okay. I know you don't like too much this idea, but that was an experiment. Project partners used their own TLA prefix to assign their customers and regional ISPs the connectivity to the IX. So this is a very, very simple picture of this idea. We have what we call the standard internet exchanger customers, which get their addressing space from the ISP as usual. And then we have what we call the next generation internet exchangers customers, which get the addressing space from the prefix allocated to the IX directly. So we have layer 2. Well, we started basically four different models for this IX infrastructure, from the traditional one to one which it's the one that we define it as the best one from the project perspective, and it's what we call it the IX Model C. So it has a layer 2 infrastructure which is fully redundant, where the internet exchanger services are placed, the router infrastructure from the long-haul providers and the customers, and what we call it the layer 3 mediation function, router, which is the real new element on this infrastructure. Okay, so the idea from the place where we come out with the idea for this structure basically come from the previous version of the RSC 2374. And here the IX plays this intermediation function role between the ISPs and the customers. Routing is about the same as you can see in any transit network. So from that sense, it's nothing new. You can have also route servers or whatever you need to run this infrastructure. We built also a lot of tools to do emulation of this before going into the real deployment. So here is how the address assignment it works. Basically, you have, of course, two options. Either the IPv6 address are assigned by the long-haul ISPs. In this case, the network itself of the project, Euro 6, was behaving as one of these long-haul providers. Sixbone was behaving like another one of these providers. And we have, for example, Sixnet, the other project that I mentioned, behaving as a third one of these long-haul providers. Or the IPv6 addressing can be assigned by the AX, as I just explained it before. Same for the routing. You have the autonomous system within the network of IXs, and you have IGP, EBGP, and so on. So from that perspective, it's nothing new, just the way that we use it within our network. From the service perspective, what we try to do is also to understand how making services available in the Internet Exchange can be interesting for the ISPs and also for the customers. So making the IX as a kind of place where these services could be concentrated, and some of the services that we had were basic network services like multicast, AAA, quality of service, DNSSEC, mobility services, transition mechanism, route server mechanism, different kind of applications like in any data internet data center, like web servers, FTP, SMTP, video conference, e-learning, point-to-point peer-to-peer applications, and also a lot of monitoring services. The idea somehow is also to see this kind of IX as a possible way for the ISPs to create virtual ISPs. Okay. I know they don't like.
So Jordi, yeah. A layer 3-based infrastructure that provides services and addresses to the customers is traditionally called an ISP. And ISPs and IXPs doing the job of ISPs has traditionally not been very long-lived.
I think this is, Randy Bush, IIJ, I think this is wonderful. IPv6 exchange points can do this, whereas IPv4 exchange points just switch traffic. This is a fantastic advantage
okay.
of IPv6.
I thought you don't like it. Okay, so one very concrete example of this Internet Exchange, which is live still, because when the project finished, some of the partners decided to take it down, but some others decided to keep it working. And this is the case for the UK Internet Exchange, or UK 6X, which in the nomenclature of the project was called Long 6. Which is, as I just explained, the Model C, a mix of Layer 2 and Layer 3 IPv6 Internet Exchange. It was the first one in UK to offer IPv6 services, use commercial IPv6 addresses. At that time, when we started the project, there was a lot of usage of Sixbone. Now it's obviously not longer necessary and not recommended. So it's located in Telehouse. It's an open Internet Exchanger. And it's still following the aims of the project of motivating the deployment of IPv6 and further understanding of IPv6. I guess that's not anymore needed so much, but that was one of the basic goals. So they have an Ethernet switch for the layer 2 peering. They have an ATM switch for additional customer access mechanisms. They have a router for the layer 3 functionality. They use the 2001.618/32 prefix for the user address allocation, and then they have for their own infrastructure the 2001.7FA. They have different tools like Looking Glass, ASP.3, and so on. And they have also different kind of services like mobility services, streaming services, even a Debian mirror, and so on. This is the basic structure. They have also connectivity to GPRS networks, and we did, in fact, a lot of demonstrations and activities with GPRS and mobility, which IPv6. They have transition mechanisms, like I just mentioned, 6-to-4, tunnel broker, and so on. I think they also deployed Teredo Relay. I am not sure right now, but I am almost sure. One of the services that we tried also is DNS services in general, and especially DNSSEC services. From the perspective of what you may know about DNSSEC, it's nothing new, just making this service available from the change. So as I just was trying to explain a couple of slides ago, I think I got interrupted and forgot about it. Basically, the idea was also, from this perspective, you can create, let's say, white box virtual ISPs. So you have several ISPs sharing some infrastructure. They can probably lower their cost if they can put together data centers and most of the services. And of course, that has good advantages from the perspective of saving costs, but it has disadvantages in the sense of they are competing or they are, let's say, less competitive from the customer because the customer is not tied to the address of an ISP, because even if he changes the ISP within the same region where the AX is located, he will still keep the same addresses. So from the customer perspective, it may be very nice, but from the ISPs, that may be a disadvantage, obviously. And I think, well, that's the final general vision of this structure, where you have all the security, quality of service and services, transition mobility, that may be somehow some of them collocated in the IX itself. And I was actually quicker than I expected. That's it.
Curious Linguist NetNode. And I'd just like to paraphrase my dear friend Brando here. And I sincerely encourage all my competing IXPs to do this.
Okay.
the ones of you who want to have remaining cash flows, on the other hand, if there is something useful you like to do about IPv6, you would go to your local friendly RAR and ask for your IXP address space, and then you leave this to your customers, the ISPs who traditionally provide services, to exchange traffic over your LAN, and as they've always done, and you would just go on minding your own business. Which is what the rest of us do.
Yeah. I must say that we got, of course, negative feedback, but also we got some positive feedback. And actually, I remember right now, I don't remember exactly what city, but somebody in Canada was telling us that they are actually, I'm talking about 2 years ago or 1 year and a half ago, they said they like it a lot, the idea, and actually they deployed an IX following our model. And at the moment, they didn't complain it, so I don't know. I guess everything has good things, bad things, advantages, disadvantages. That was a research project, an experiment. The IX was the, let's say, a starting point for creating this project, but the important thing for the project was also all the IPv6 movement that we created around the IX and a lot of development activities, porting of applications. And yes, the IX was an important part, but there was a lot of additional things. And I cannot disclose, because that was part of the confidentiality for some parts of the project, but there are some of the European telcos that participated in the project that actually designed business models following this approach. And, well, I don't know what they are going to do, if they are going to deploy it commercially or not, but some of them have very, very interesting ideas out of this model. So, of course, it may happen, it may not. Maybe some people like it, maybe some people dislike, but it's one more possibility.
Jordi,
yeah.
The fact that someone, Bill Woodcock, the fact that someone expressed a preference for this 2 years ago and hasn't complained since does not strike me as strong evidence that they are still
in operation
today. It was a kind
of joke.
Today.
Okay. All right. Randy Bush, IIJ. Jordi, the truth is, or at least my perception is, that what we're really looking at here is an IPv6 multi-provider deployment test bed, not an exchange point, at least not with the words we're used to about exchange point. And so we can make a lot of fun, but indeed if we turn this and look at it as a V6 multi-provider deployment test bed, then there are probably some lessons learned. And it would be fun next time, maybe not at an IX SIG, but at a V6 SIG, to know what worked well, what didn't, and why.
Well,
And that would be very helpful because despite the fact we make all the jokes, many of us are living with V6 to some extent. I mean, you know, I am from IIJ. So what works, what doesn't, et cetera. To many of us, some of this tunneling stuff is horribly scary and less bad lessons we've learned, et cetera. But there are other things you're trying that I would like to know, you know, not the marketing side, but why some things didn't work and what we have to do to make them work.
Yeah, you're right on that, and that probably, as you said, belong not to the IX SIG. But there was something that I think I had in one of the slides, but maybe I mistaken the slide set. There was something that was a very evident learned lesson. It's that if you do this, obviously you cannot predict the return path for your traffic, but that's something that we know very well also from IPv4. So that's the main learned lesson from this model, and this is a problem that if we go into this model or if somebody goes into this model, need to understand that very clearly. You cannot predict where you are getting the traffic back. That's a very, very important lesson.
So,
do we have any other questions or comments for Jordi?
I really have to say this. We've been telling people that there's nothing like a layer 3 extension point. I think you need to correct your slides. I mean, that's really bad message to send out to people, still saying that there exists a layer 3 extension point. Really bad.
You work for PCH. PCH was pushing layer 3 exchange points for years. You want the email right now? From you, Woody.
Okay. Thank you very much, Jordi. Okay, next up we have Serge Radovic from not an internet exchange point, but EuroIX. Because people seem to think that EuroIX is an internet exchange point.
That's on my first slide.
So we go from not really an exchange point to definitely not an exchange point. Normally, as chair,
so where is the not an exchange point SIG where we can hear about exchange points?
That's what I'm
next session.
I don't normally comment on presentations as chair. Maybe I should. Okay, Serge, it is yours.
Thanks, Phil. Okay, my name is Serge Radovic, and I'm from EuroIX. Well, one thing I do want to do, and I tried it, I was in Mumbai, in Senog, and I always try and get more participation from the audience. And last time I had some test questions during the presentation, and people weren't allowed to have lunch until they'd answered the test questions right. And that worked really well, yeah, because most people ate. But this time I've done something different. There's a little, I've got a prize, something in this bag. It's that big. And it's from I won't tell you who it's from, but there is a prize in there. There's a spelling mistake somewhere in the presentation. So the first person who picks it up, but please do leave it till the end, will win that prize. I said leave it to the end, Bill. The spelling mistake isn't. So I'm glad to be back. This is my third time here at APNIC. One of the reasons I'm here is to learn more about the region, and while I'm here, I thought I'd give you an update on a few of the trends and statistics that are going on in Europe. I haven't got a battery, so I haven't got a power, so hopefully that doesn't connect. Okay, EuroIX was originally, and it still is, called the European Internet Exchange Association. It was formed in May 2001. As of January last year, we decided to invite IXs from outside the region to join EuroIX. EuroIX is not an exchange point. We're not an exchange point. We are an association of exchange points. So it doesn't matter how many times I say this. People will come to me in the coffee break and say, how much does a 1 gig port cost at EuroIX? But it'll always happen. But we're not an exchange point. We're an association of exchange points. Now, we currently have 37 affiliated IXPs. 33 of those are in Europe, and 4 of those are outside of Europe. Since I gave my last presentation in Kyoto, Equinix decided to join. Bill, you didn't even know. Six, Slovenia joined. TIX, Tuscany in Florence, Italy joined. And our latest associate member to join, that's an IX outside of Europe, is JPIX. And we currently have another associate member who's just filled in an application form. I do once a month, I don't know why, but it ends up being in the middle of the month, I do an aggregated peak traffic of the member IXPs that have public traffic stats. That happens to be about 28 European IXPs at the moment, and those peak stats, which don't all occur at the same time, but of the peak stats, comes to around just over 500 gigs per sec. This time last year, it was about 272, so it's roughly an 84% increase over the last 12 months. Over the last month, we've had about a 7.2 increase. Works out to roughly 17.9 gigs per IX. We have one IX doing around 130, 135 gigs. There's currently 16 European member IXPs that are now offering 10 gig e-ports, and a couple of them got quite high take-ups. Some more stats of all the members, and that's including the IXs that I have outside of the European region. We have 2,520 connectees to those 37 members. If you go to the EuroIX website, we have a couple of tools. One is what we call the EuroIX database. And basically, I get the IXs to list the ASNs and the name of everyone that's joined. So you can see now it's 2,543, and you can search there. And if you want, do a search on IXs or names or AS numbers if you're looking for someone to peer with. Another little tool that we made was the IXP peering matrix, so you can also compare EuroIX member IXPs against each other and look for unique or non-unique AS numbers. So there are a couple of tools we've got. Going back. About 1,400 unique ASNs of the people that are connected to my member IXPs, which works out to roughly 260 megs peak traffic per customer. We hold a benchmarking club for our all our members. And in one of the sections, we had 30 IXPs fill in the benchmarking club at EuroIX, and they were all European. The average price of a 1 gig port is €850. This time last year, we also did a benchmarking club, and it was €880, so it's definitely not going up. This is the makeup of our IX membership. We have small, medium, and very large IXPs. We have them from those that were established in 1993, all the way through to 2002. We have Cisco is the most common switches used, followed by Extreme Foundry, and we have a few others. Forstner are also coming into the picture now. What we offer our members IXPs, the usual stuff, mailing lists, website listings, the portal, what you saw there with the tools that we offer. Probably one of the biggest values to the members is the forums that we hold twice a year. A couple of times we've had more than 30 IXPs at these forums, and they've proved really successful, and we're going to continue doing them. I mentioned the benchmarking club. We also have a number of information repositories, maintenance diaries, so that people can keep an eye on when the maintenance is occurring. The switch database, which I think is quite useful, and people, if they've got similar switches, have a look at what software is being put on, and then they can always give the IXP a call and say, hey, did you guys have any trouble going up to that software or using those switches or whatever? So it's quite a detailed list of the switches being used by the exchanges. All this information is behind the members' pages. Plans for 2006. Well, our next forum's coming up in Dublin, Ireland, on the 8th and 9th of May. We're considering taking a more active role in public affairs. It's still a discussion that's going on within our membership and something we'll talk about in Dublin. Of course, we're always looking for more and varied members from Europe and around the world. And, of course, we're also investigating further ways to collaborate with IXPs, which we'll go in and discuss soon. If you're an IXP in the room and you'd like to join your IX or talk about the possibilities of joining, or you're an ISP that's part of an IXP that would like to join your IX, then please come and speak to me or have a look at the contact details that I've got there up on the screen. And that's about it. I know, it's going to be the original. Yes, Bill.
You said something about comparing performance metrics from different IXs, and somehow I'm afraid that the performance metrics you're talking about are not bits forwarded per euro. What metric did you have in mind?
You mean in the benchmarking club?
Yeah.
That we're doing? We have about 8 different sections. It goes from... It does talk about traffic. It talks about number of members, increase in the membership, staff issues, how much staff costs, how many staff these people have. We do have a lot of different models, so it becomes hard to compare. You have to take that into
bits
account.
Bits forwarded per staff person would also be an acceptable metric, I think.
Okay, well...
Bits forwarded per euro would be more direct.
From the information that we provide, you could probably work that out.
Yeah, okay.
Are there any other questions? No one wants to claim the prize? No one picked the mistake? Which fees? The UIX fees? We have fees. Okay, that's about the... If you are interested, the current membership fees are 4,000 euros for a European IXP. If you're outside of Europe, it's 2,500 euros. We are non-for-profit. The fees aren't of the highest concern to us, so come and talk to me if you'd really like to become a member. And that's it for the UIX update.
Okay, thanks very much, sir. Okay, the final item on the agenda for this session is the Exchange Point panel discussion. Serge is going to lead that, and Chihu and I are basically going to move off the podium.
I think there's about 4 or 5 of you that know you should be sitting up here, so if you could come and sit up here, please.
So
you don't need laptops or anything. No, I mean, I've got every... Well, that's... Well, you need something.
So but 4 or 5.
No, there's 5. Phil, get off.
Okay.
I'll go.
Well, there should be 5. Who am I missing?
If you need your laptop, I can read that. You want your laptop. So, Serge, if I happen to be the chair of Eurex and I was supposed to be mistaken, do I get the prize now?
It was a big pen, so don't worry. You're
there you go.
Curtis actually won the prize. Can I borrow that? Okay. Thanks, Phil. When Phil asked, when he sent out the call for presentations, one of the topics that he had was IXP collaboration. And I thought, wow, well, that's pretty interesting to me. And I didn't notice anyone else put their hand up, so I thought, okay, well, maybe I can attempt something here. I guess one thing I want to make quite clear from the start is I've got these five guys up here representing, well, let's representing five different continents, but I think most of what they're going to say is their own personal opinions, unless they express otherwise. So I don't think anyone should be held to what to say. And I'm just looking to do a bit of an informal discussion to see where we might go with all of this, and is there something we want to do? So I just wanted to say that at the start. Okay, I had a bit of a look through the... What does my keyboard work? Excuse me. Having a Microsoft moment on my Mac. Okay, I had a bit of a look through the APNIC archives, and I came along with this quote, which I thought was a good way to start it. I think it was during... It was a few years ago. I don't know who said it, but I thought that was a good way to round it up. I think it was actually after a... I don't know where it came from, but I think it's... I think it works quite well here. Anyway, I want to introduce my panel first. This is pretty much the order that I'm going to ask the panel to talk about the regions in. Bill, Herman, Adil, and Curtis, and Gorab. And you can see which regions I'll be talking about. Okay, basically I'm going to quickly go through. How much time have we got? Okay, so we'll go through it quite quickly. I want to quickly talk about what collaboration is. Then we're going to go through a tour of the world, what is going on in each of the five regions around the world, and then we'll have a bit of an open discussion about where we think we might want things to go. So what is collaboration? Well, I've got a couple of definitions. First one I came across was this one, and I wasn't sure if this is what you were talking about or not, Phil, but... So possibly not. So I had another good look around because I couldn't think of any others, and I thought this would be a little bit more fitting. So it's definition two that we're working on here today. Although sometimes, through my experience in UIX, yeah. So we're looking at collaboration in the absolute broader sense of the word, from things that are going on, as I just explained at UIX, to discussions, the SIG we're in now. So I really want to people to keep that in mind. We're really looking at it, the broader sense of the word. So I'll get straight into it. We'll do a little tour of the world. As I said, we'll start with North America. I think there's also a portable microphone there, guys. Maybe you can give us a quick rundown on how many IXPs there are in the region. It's on the presentation. I hope you guys can see it. Anything specific about the IXPs in your region, and what form of collaboration in any sense of the word is going on at the moment? So over to you, Bill.
So North America has been marked by a kind of stark division between commercial operators of exchange facilities and non-commercial exchange facilities. And to some degree, that's true everywhere, but in North America, it tends to be a little bit more pronounced than most places. That has led to some kind of odd forms of collaboration. So instead of having something like this forum in the U.S., we've got a lot of things in which Internet Exchange commercial operators pitch their services to peering coordinators. So where a panel like this would be operators of commercial exchanges, and the people in the audience would, rather than being people interested in exchange points themselves, would be peering coordinators from ISPs. And in fact, anymore, it wouldn't be a panel with people sitting in an audience. It would be happening on a cruise ship, as this has sort of devolved from Pax and Equinix, each supporting kind of contending peering forums each once a year, to, I guess, it became more than once a year each, and it sort of became this thing where three times a year. Okay, so, and it became too much of a hassle for everybody, right? Nobody can go to three each of these each year, regardless of how much vacation time they have or how much their boss is willing to let them go do this instead of their jobs. So they've consolidated, and I guess AM6 and NOTA, and who else is involved?
D6
are all sort of jointly sponsoring this thing where peering coordinators go and cruise around the Caribbean in a cruise ship for a week or something. Hosting, excuse me. I'm obviously a little bit dubious as to the value of a week on a cruise ship instead of a week behind the desk getting work done. Bill will argue with me here.
Should I do it now or Mike?
Sure, go ahead. Sure.
Hi, this is Bill Norton from Equinix. Understand that for peering coordinators, their job is to interact with each other. So they're not sitting behind a desk as an alternative to doing their job. They're actually going on this cruise to do their job face-to-face, which is oftentimes much more effective than interacting with other peering coordinators via email. So that's number one. They aren't going off on their vacation. Many of them see this as so important, though, that they are taking vacation time in order to go on this cruise. So that's one thing. The second thing is Josh Snowhorn actually started the initiative of doing this on a cruise for a couple reasons, but one of which was interesting, and that is it's actually less expensive to do this peering forum on a cruise than it is to rent a hotel with all the catering and all the food and the associated room nights and all that kind of stuff. It's actually cheaper to do it on the cruise where the food is already included, and the cruise lines now are bending over backwards so that they can facilitate this business meeting, this business interaction. So I'm just bringing this up because it sounded like you were kind of poo-pooing the idea as a fun cruise around the Caribbean, and it's going to be some fun, but there are also full days of agenda here.
Randy Bush, IJ. Bill, how do we become peering coordinators?
Yeah. I say this mostly not to convey an overly large measure of scorn, which I shouldn't and I don't need to, but to give an idea of the tone of communication where it's going in North America. The fact of the matter is that we have NANOG meetings 3 times a year. We have ERIN meetings 2x a year. There is not really serious discussion of internet exchanges at those, as there is at APNIC and at RIPE and at AFNOG and at LACNIC / NAPLA. We do have a lot of communication about peering and very little about exchange points. Partly that's because of the commercial nature, some degree of commercial secrecy, the competitive nature, and also the fact that we're not really on the cutting edge of exchange point engineering in North America in the way that, say, Seoul is, or London or Amsterdam. We have a lot of kind of medium-sized exchanges where people are not trying really to push 10 gigs through the switch too much. We've got a few 10-gig peers in some places. The big guys are at 10 gigs, right? Nobody's doubling up or tripling up 10-gig ports or anything like that. We're gradually moving from the center of things to becoming a backwater in terms of development of new technology and deployment of new technology and discussion of new ideas. So I think that's it for me.
Okay, thanks, Bill. Okay, let's move a bit south down to Latin America. Herman?
Ready. Regarding the effort for organizations for IXPs in Latin America, there is an informal group called named NAPLA. They have been having meetings since 2001, and the most recent or the most part of the agenda of these meetings were to experience exchange, discussing best practices for the operation of these IXPs, the reviewing of procedures, services, and the organization ways of these of these meetings. Last month, we from LACNIC we started an effort to create a permanent forum where all IXPs from Latin America be involved and can participate. And until last month, last February, there was not any kind of weight or media where this organization can change experience beyond this meeting that they had organized every year. But after the meeting, they lose contact and they see again the next year. The process right now is to establish this permanent forum. They are going to have a meeting with LACNIC in Guatemala next May. We are trying to invite and try to participate the 26 IXPs that exist in our region. At least that's the number that we have so far. This involves 10 countries, 10 different countries in Latin America. I highlight two countries here, which is Cuba and Chile, which are the only ISPs which are regulated by the government. And the one of the projects that has been discussing during these meetings of NAFLA and that is going to be discussed again in May is about a regional interconnection project that has been the main topic in the agenda for this meeting. these countries which exist in IXPs are Argentina, Brazil, Chile, Colombia, Cuba, Ecuador, Nicaragua, Panama, Paraguay, and Peru. It's interesting that in Mexico there is no IXP existing there in Mexico, mostly because there is a predominant ISP which everybody is connected with him, and also if they can also ISP can connect very in a cheaper way with the United States carriers. So the project run IXP in Mexico never accomplished. I think more or less is the situation in Latin America. It's important also to say that this organization NAFLA is very eager to learn from other experiences. I mean, it has been some cases in South America where they have problems in the relationship in the association of the IXPs because the bylaws were not very clear, or some dominant ISPs take advantage of the situation and made some movement that was not considered fair. And in general, people is trying to learn the experience on other sides of the world with other colleagues in South America, Latin America. And I think it's a very interesting group that is pushing to have a very well organized meeting organization, which is NAFLA.
Okay, thanks, Herman. We'll head across the waters to Africa. Adil.
The situation in Africa is not very different from Latin America. But one thing special in Africa is that the history or the legacy of the internet itself make the exchange point setup in Africa a bit more difficult, because in most of the country there was a monopolistic telecommunication company. which tried to kill all the new initiative and new small ISP. But the environment is changing very, very rapidly, and there is a more and more cooperation initiative coming in different countries in Africa. And as soon as ISP start talking together, they start moving from this concurrential and killing environment, to something which is more focused on, first of all, the user need and also for their cost, an efficient use of their cost. As we know that in our region, we have the one of the most highest connection international transit costs. So they start working. In our region, we have about 10 internet exchange points over the 54 countries. And the last one was the one set up in Mauritius 2 months ago. We have received 3 new requests for IP address for new exchange point also ongoing to be set up. So I will say that the situation is changing. 2 things, there is AFRISPA, which is the African ISP Association, has done a lot by encouraging ISP association to set up exchange point where there is a ISP association. So most of the country which are running exchange points has ISP association, so that make it a bit more easier. I will say also that the WSIS process somehow has helped many countries also to start looking at internet in another way. And in many declarations in Africa, in political declarations, unfortunately, there is a goodwill to encourage exchange points in different countries and facilitate the setup of local traffic exchange, which is, for me, is a good thing, because politicians still have a very powerful influence in this area in Africa. So we will expect an evolution on exchange point in the coming years in Africa. Last month, the board, Africanic board, has taken the decision to allow free IP or resource allocation to exchange point, which is a way for us to support the exchange point setup. And we are also discussing with AFRISPA to formalize a kind of cooperation, especially to support exchange point setup in Africa. One of the things is to set up local exchange point, but what would be the best in our region also is to move one level ahead and set up regional exchange point, allowing exchange point already set up to be connected within to each other, so that we can really maximize the international transit cost. That is all about exchange points in Africa, and we'll see what the upcoming year will give us in that area.
Okay, thanks, Adil. Should we take a little boat north across the Mediterranean to Europe? And let Curtis take over.
Right. So I guess Europe is in maybe, I don't know, the home of some of the exchange point cooperation that started within the EIX working group at RIPE, where the exchange points got together since quite long back and discussed common issues and common problems. One of the first results of that was the development of the Switch wish list, which was, well, Mike from Lynx is sitting at back, part of helping up setting up a list of the exchange points collaborating around working together around which feature sets they needed for hardware and for functionality. And of course, that more or less developed into EuroX, which Serge presented before. And through EuroX, the exchange points in Europe actually have quite a lot of interaction with each other. We share and discuss quite a lot of knowledge. We had the 2 forums a year with all the EuroX members going to. And there's also a lot of interaction between the IXS directly. From my own experience, we have when NetNode did our last selection of hardware platforms, for example, we actually worked together with Lynx and M6 and invited them to come and share their experiences with their current vendors and platforms. And there's a lot of this exchange of information going on between the exchange points in Europe. There is also, in most of the countries, there's also various forms of operator forums. The UK, NOG in the UK, Swedish Operator Forum in Stockholm, etc. And they, through these forums, the exchange points in the countries will also have interaction for that particular country and do a lot more work together. So in Europe, there's actually quite a lot of this collaboration going on, and there's a lot of interaction, exchange of ideas, develop tools, resources, and to some extent, I think there's also been exchange of staff and sharing of common resources. I think that covers it.
Okay, thanks, Curtis. Well, I'll leave the best to last since we're in the Asia-Pacific region. Gaurav, if you'll go through that for us.
Slides. Okay. Yeah. I can't see the slides, so I'll just go on with what I have on my piece of paper. But most of the things that I'm going to tell are things that I've learned from the APNIC IXSIG. In fact, just went through all the previous presentations done at IXSIG in the last few years. I just know what's happening in the IXSIG, in the IX arena in Asia-Pac. Mainly, there are two extremes in Asia-Pac. With countries like Japan and Korea who are asking for 100 gig E platforms for exchanging traffic, and there are countries in Asia-Pac, again, which don't actually have an exchange point at all. And there are some exchange points who average around 6 meg, 7 meg. At the same time, there are exchanges in Japan, like multiple exchanges in Japan, which heat out multiple gigabytes of traffic every day or every second. So when we talk about Asia-Pac, in terms of collaborations, I think due to these extremes of exchange point operations, we have not actually seen a lot of active collaboration between exchange points. One of the regular forums where probably IXP operators meet has been Apricot and APNIC meetings. We have the IXSIG at APNIC for a while now, which is where we are. We also have the peering track and the IXP operations discussions and track at Apricot for a while now. I mean, as far as I can remember back in time. So which means that there is increasing number of activity, but I don't know. Bill, how many speakers from ACI did you have in the last 3 years? Bill Norton.
At where?
In the peering track. Apricot.
I don't know. Do you want me to look it up?
Yeah, that'll be a useful thing. So, as I was saying, a lot of speakers here are still from outside the region when it comes to peering and things like that. So, I've not seen that happen here. But I'm actually sitting down here, I wrote down a couple of areas. There seems to be some collaboration going on between exchange point operations in Japan and Korea, mainly due to the high demand for switching fabric. Last year, we had IXP switch wish list at Apricot, and we had multiple requests, people saying we need 100 gig E, forget 40 gig E, that's the old sort of thing going on. Second in line, I think Hong Kong is basically very distributed exchange point fabric. SKIX is omnipresent. Everybody over the city connects through the fiber to the SKIX. And is there Singapore is the only place where a commercial exchange actually has made any route outside of Japan, which is the Equinix IX, and Singapore is taking some point. Except for these three main places, all other countries more or less seems to have not-for-profit IXs, in which the ones in Taiwan, Korea are pretty big, or there are multiple exchange points there. We have new coming up exchange points in India, Nepal, Bangladesh, Lanka, and so on. The exchange point in Australia, I mean, there's one in Pipe Networks operates a couple of exchange points in Australia. There's WAX, and of course in New Zealand we have multiple exchange points all operating by CityLink. A lot of other things within about exchange point. Still, there are lots of countries, especially in Southeast Asia. Like I have a list here which says basically Thailand, Malaysia, Philippines, all of these countries actually have monopoly sort of transit IX operating there. So old PTT is still providing IXP transit services. The exception is Indonesia in the region, where ABSI successfully runs a pretty good exchange point in Jakarta, actually with three nodes. And then Curtis didn't mention Middle East, so I'll just mention it. It seems like there is predominantly one or two transit providers in the Middle East, not really an exchange point anywhere there. And the area is so large that, and as it says on the slide, the NGNOG probably talks a lot about exchange points other than drinking beer. I've been told that the JANOG, when necessary, talks about exchange points and switching technologies in general. At SANOG, we regularly have an IXP track or people talking about exchange points. That's pretty interesting because we have a couple of new exchange points coming up. And as I said, there's Apricot and there's APNIC IXing. And well, that's it. There's not a lot of collaborations happening within SEPAC. And I think the only peering forum we ever had was an Equinix one, which was in Singapore and Sydney or something like that. And Pipe Networks has been promoting OGNOG, which I don't know if it's working or not because I've been to only one, which is a couple of hours of heavy drinking beer or something like that. So other forums, I don't know. So that's it.
Okay. Yes.
Bill will give the numbers.
Bill, do you have those numbers?
I just had this year and last year.
Yeah, that works.
Okay. This year we had six speakers and Stephen Baxter was the only one from the region.
Okay. Last year.
Last year we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 speakers and 3 are from the region.
Good.
Okay, so this year we had 6 speakers and last year we had 6 speakers, this year we had 8 speakers.
Other way.
Last year we had
three.
Right. So yeah.
Anyway, on average there's 7 speakers per year.
Oh, it's there for you. So
okay.
So that, my point there was we're still not getting a lot of operators speaking up at all in the forums in the region as well. So that's what I was talking about in the IXSIG, and I do an IXSIG presentation every 6 months, and I don't see a lot of people doing that. So if you get more of people doing presentations from Asia, probably a lot more useful to increase collaborations. Thanks.
Okay, thanks, Gaurav. All right, so globally, I guess I'll do a bit of a wrap-up. The figures, according to what we put up there, and Bill handed over to me, comes to around 260 IXs in the world. My numbers are a little bit lower, but I think it's somewhere around that region anyway. We can agree on that. As I said in my presentation, EuroX has gone outside of Europe now, so I guess as a form of collaboration, EuroX is starting to move globally. We have 4, looking to be 5 IXs that are outside of Europe joining, and I'm hoping to do more. PCH, I've put them there. IXP, construction, information repositories, I think this can be thrown in the same area. The peering DB, and the chat channel as well, the HashIX. I think this is also a form of collaboration. So that's about it. I was going to ask, we haven't got much time, just a few minutes to go. I guess I'm going to have to skip this little bit, and I've got a few questions up here that I'm pretty much posing to you guys. I don't know if there's any questions from the audience. Do you mind using the microphone, Bill?
Bill Norton from Equinix. I want to thank you guys for putting this together because I think generally speaking, there's not a whole lot of exchange point operator to exchange point operator cooperation. I mean, of the 260, from what I've seen, the European exchange point operators are very sharing of information, sharing notes on equipment, what works, what doesn't work, and so forth, which kind of brings me to my question. Why is it in an exchange point operator's best interest, selfish best interest, to have more cooperation with those who may compete with them either directly or indirectly?
So, Bill, a very simple answer is that most of the European exchanges don't compete. We are non-for-profits.
That's true. The 80% of IXPs in Europe are
not-for-profits. The notion of competition
and you're geographically separate.
Sorry?
And you're geographically diverse.
Well, there's 8 of them in London alone.
Yeah, yeah, London, and there are a couple special cases, but most are diverse. Randy Bush, IJ. I think there's a social physics that happens in this and many other things. and you can see it in the operator mailing lists, you can see it in so on and so forth. And that is, when there's a small number of entities, they all communicate with each other. When there get to be 260 of them, if it starts, it's too much noise, and people start to localize. Look what's happening with the OG mailing list and the OGs. There's now Sanog and Zinog, Norjanog, so on and so forth. It's trying to get the room small enough that you can have a reasonable conversation and that you have common interests. And I don't mean to discourage global organization, but I suspect that there are enough there that what's happening is the regionals are where the strength is going to be. And as someone who's worked a long time to push some of the momentum southward into America Latina and Africa, I think having cooperation in your two regions and strength there rather than having more honkies coming down from the north.
Yeah, I don't think I'm advocating the fact that we should make this a global IX. That could be the case if that's what the IXPs want. But we at EURIX initially thought, well, what's going on in Asia is really, really interesting. We want to know more about this. And the Asians want to know more about us. And we've got a lot of experience that we can share with each other, so why not join up?
What Randy is saying strikes me as right. What I would say maybe an exception, though, is publication of research and documents, in that dragging everybody from all over the world to a spot to talk in person and try and get the room size right, yeah, is a difficult problem, and you may not wind up with people who have interesting things to say and so forth. But on the other hand, encouraging people who do have something interesting to say to publish it and get it out on the web where people can find it would, I think, make a big difference. The Koreans, for instance, I would love to see more about how it is they manage to handle the volume of traffic they do. And it's really difficult to get anything not in Hangul out of Korea to find that out. And so you've got folks like Lynx and AM6 doing lab work that's, you know, they're working really hard on that. And a lot of the answers they want, they could have gotten from Koreans 18 months earlier.
I think another element of it, by the way, is I think a large percent of us read each other's mailing lists already. You know, how many people here read Nanog, Sanog, da-da-da-da-da?
Sure.
One of the things with Asia is also the languages are so diverse in Asia that, you know, collaboration is really, really difficult. I mean, I know that talk to a lot of people here at Apricot, and well, we can talk with each other when we are here, but communicating in, for both of us, a second language, which is English, over email.
All talking in a non-Asian language.
Yeah. That becomes really, really difficult. I mean, for me, English is second language. For a lot of participants at Apricot, English is not their primary language. And of course, email is a written form of communication is really something that is new for most people. So, I mean, I work in South Asia, and each time there is a problem, say in Bangladesh or something, I mean, we've got some collaboration between the exchange point there and Kathmandu, and I get more phone calls out of regional countries than I get emails. So there is still an oral form of communication, and email really doesn't work all the time.
I'd just like to second what Gaurab said. Even in EURIX forums, the EURIX board, which I happen to be on, have actually spent quite some time making sure that we can get everybody who doesn't have English as a native language to participate in the discussions, and that's for a region that you would suppose have maybe more knowledge, I don't know, more general knowledge of English. We don't.
Working?
Yep.
Yeah, as I experienced last year at Apricot, the Aussies and the Kiwis speak a different form of English.
Okay. I think I have to wind it up. Look, I'm going to be around today and tomorrow, so if anyone's interested in chatting with me about any ideas, concept, thoughts, criticisms, whatever, please come and approach me. Or go to the EURIX website, and you can send me an email there, Serge@EURIX. Okay. I'd like to thank the panel. And thank you, Phil.
Okay, thanks very much, Serge. We've just run a little bit over. It's the coffee break now. We've got 25 minutes before the second session begins. Start off with Stephen Baxter talking about operational experiences at an IX, and then we have lots and lots of Exchange Point updates. Thank you.